The Nature Podcast is supported by Nature Plus, a flexible monthly subscription that grants immediate online access to the science journal Nature and over 50 other journals from the Nature portfolio. More information at go.nature.com/plus.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This podcast was originally published in 2014. This is the Nature Pastcast, each month raiding Nature's archive and looking at key moments in science. In this show, it's the 1920s, and a fight is on over a fossil that came to change our view of human evolution.
Nature, February 7th, 1925. Page 195, Australopithecus africanus, the man-ape of South Africa.
The discovery of australopithecines, as they're called, was crucial for how we view human evolution.
This was the beginning of the proof that Charles Darwin was right, that the human line originated in Africa. I'm Chris Stringer, and I'm research leader in human origins at the Natural History Museum in London. Well, I've got a replica here of the material that was published in Nature in 1925, this new form of proto-human, as it was claimed at the time, called Australopithecus africanus, the southern ape of Africa.
Page 195, Australopithecus africanus, by Professor Raymond A. Dart, University of the Witwatersrand, Johannesburg, South Africa.
Raymond Dart was then a young professor of anatomy, and in 1924 he was handed a couple of boxes of material that had come out of a site called Tong, a place that was being quarried for limestone. In quarrying they were going through caves, and in these caves were fossil monkeys and other animals. So Dart got these couple of boxes of what were thought to be fossil monkeys, and in there he noticed there was a lump of limestone that seemed to be in the shape of a brain. So he thought it was very interesting, and when he looked further, he saw that there was a piece of bone in a block of matrix, in a block of cemented material, that looked like it fitted onto it.
A condition of affairs where virtually the whole face and lower jaw, replete with teeth, together with the major portion of the brain pattern, have been preserved, constitutes a specimen of unusual value in fossil anthropoid discovery.
It's fascinating to hear Dart's account of when he first opened the boxes and looked at this material. And it so happened that he got to a critical stage in the preparation of this material when he was first working on it, that he was supposed to be going to a wedding. And I think he was best man at the wedding. And he was so excited that he was still working on this fossil and he couldn't let it go.
It arrived on the day when the late Dr. Christo Bears was being married at our house. Well, I didn't know what these boxes were, but I immediately started undoing them. But while I was busy with these things, my wife told me it's about time I got ready for the wedding.
And, it really got to the very last minute, and the guy who was getting married said, "For God's sake, I'm going to have to go and find another best man unless you stop messing around with that fossil."
I'm Dean Falk, and I'm the Hale G. Smith Professor of Anthropology at Florida State University in Tallahassee. So Raymond Dart published the description and analysis of the Tong fossil on February 7th, 1925 in Nature. And what he said was that essentially he had a specimen that didn't look like an ape, it didn't look like a human, it had features of both groups, and nothing like it had ever been seen before. And although he didn't use the term missing link, in fact, that's what he thought he had.
The specimen is of importance because it exhibits an extinct race of apes, intermediate between living anthropoids and man.
He also said that this individual had walked on two legs the way we do. And he thought that because of a hole in the bottom of the skull, which transmits the spinal cord, and it was in a central position in this Tong specimen, as it is in living people.
This points to the assumption, by this fossil group, of an attitude appreciably more erect than that of modern anthropoids. It means that a greater reliance was being placed upon the feet as organs of progression.
So he thought he had a bipedal man ape. The world wasn't ready in 1925 for this paper or this discovery. For one thing, fundamentalism, religious fundamentalism, was at an all-time high. So creationists were not ready to accept an ancestor that looked somewhat ape-like. Scientists also were not ready to receive this new discovery, because they already thought they knew where our ancestors came from. You know, they accepted evolutionary theory, but they thought that our oldest ancestor came from England, and that it was represented by something called Piltdown Man.
And Piltdown Man was thought to be a kind of British missing link, I don't like using the term, but that's what it was called at the time. And a lot of British experts believed in the Piltdown finds as being a genuine kind of early human ancestor, and it looked nothing like this specimen from Tong. So they preferred Piltdown, and therefore they sidelined this specimen from Tong.
The creme de la creme of the paleontologists in that day were in London, and they had trained Dart. So they sent Dart, who was younger than them, off to South Africa, and what they didn't expect was that this young whippersnapper would, within 2 years, find and describe a completely new and different and really important specimen related to human evolution. And so they, although they initially congratulated Dart during the first week after the announcement in February of 1925, very soon after that, the peers, his colleagues in England, came down really hard on Dart and rejected the significance of Tong. They said, no, this is not a missing link. This is not our ancestor. Our ancestor's over here in England. In 1953, Piltdown Man was proven to be this horrible hoax that had gone on since it was announced in 1912.
But unfortunately, acceptance of Piltdown definitely held up the acceptance of the Tong material, and evidence eventually would come through that Dart was right in many of his claims.
Raymond Dart was tremendously hurt and upset at the beating he took from the scientists of the day. It deeply upset him, and what he did in response was he knew that he had to write a much more thorough documentation of the find and its significance. So he worked for 4 years, from 1925 to 1929, and produced a really, really long book describing the nitty-gritty about Tong and the group it was from. And he submitted it to the Royal Society in England, hoping for publication, and that did not happen. This monograph was rejected, and so it sits in the archives of the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa, if you would like to go read it. And it's really criminal, actually, that it's not been published.
Certainly, for at least the next 10 years, Dart had a hard time in getting over this viewpoint. But, of course, in the 1930s, more material turned up from various parts of the world that certainly suggested Piltdown was, there was something wrong with Piltdown. It was an oddity. Nothing else was like it. So Piltdown was increasingly sidelined and therefore became less influential in the arguments. But also, people in the 1930s and 40s started to find more material of Australopithecus from other sites in South Africa, and they started to find adult individuals. And that got over the problem of people saying, oh, well, it would have grown up to look like an ape, because these creatures turning up in other South African caves clearly were walking upright. There were not only parts of skulls, but even parts of the hip bones that showed these creatures did indeed walk upright, as Dart had guessed, really. It was a guess in 1925.
Eventually, Dart's find was accepted by the scientific community and is still accepted today. Raymond Dart lived to be 95. He died in 1988. And so he had the pleasure of seeing the field come around and accept the importance of the genus and species he named.
And he lived long enough to see the Australopithecines recognized as a stage in human evolution, that they were on the human line. And he developed some wide-ranging theories about the Australopithecines and their role in human evolution. And he wasn't right about everything. So, for example, he believed that these creatures were probably hunters, were carnivorous, meat-eating, that they probably lived in the caves, and that the bones of the other animals in the caves were actually their prey, and they had lived in the caves, brought back animals to eat, and then these other bones in the caves were the prey of the Australopithecines. And we now know that wasn't the story, that both those other animals and the Australopithecines were probably preyed on rather than being predators. There's been work suggesting that the Tung specimen itself might have been the victim of a bird of prey, which actually had seized the head of the child and then dropped it into the Tung site.
We know today that our earliest ancestors that walked on two legs emerged in Africa and evolved in Africa. Eventually, they gave rise to another genus, the genus Homo, which is our own genus. And individuals in Homo took over the world. So the discovery of Australopithecines was pivotal for contemporary paleoanthropology.
You've been listening to the Nature Pastcast. This month's contributors were archaeologist Chris Stringer of the Natural History Museum in London and paleoanthropologist Dean Falk at Florida State University. The music was Underneath the Monkey Moon by Arthur Collins and Byron Harlan, recorded in 1922 and downloaded from the Free Music Archive. This podcast was produced by me, Kerry Smith. Next month's episode is the last in the Nature Pastcast series. We travel back to the 1930s and the story of a man who chased solar eclipses.
The Nature Podcast is supported by Nature Plus, a flexible monthly subscription that grants immediate online access to the science journal Nature and over 50 other journals from the Nature portfolio. More information at go.nature.com/plus.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.